Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRue Show for August 17th, 2013. This is Michelle Steinberg, standing in for our regular host, Marcia Mary Baker. And this is a special edition of the LaRue Show today. It is called Report from Atlanta, Forget About Your Money, You're Fighting for Your Life. And our guests today are Diane Sayre of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee and Lena Platt, organizer with the LaRouche PAC in California. So welcome, Lena and Diane.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks.
Okay, so let me give a little background. Diane was one of the leaders of the LaRouche PAC organizing force at the recent Atlanta, Georgia conference of the National Conference of State Legislators. At that conference, there was a pitched battle over the reinstatement of the vital Glass-Steagall banking law, where the bankers' lobby came out in force to stop Glass-Steagall. Now, let's get this straight. These are state legislators. They are the closest elected body to the people of the United States. But they do not have the power to legislate Glass-Steagall. That's a national law. So this is a battle for a bridge between the people of the United States and the U.S. Congress. But the bankers' lobby were completely freaked out, and I think it is unprecedented to see the lobbyists trying to go hand-to-hand combat against a real grassroots force, and we're going to get a real picture of that. Our other guest, Lena Platt, has been active in getting the resolution for Glass-Steagall reinstatement support for the congressional action introduced in California. California is a vital state with a huge congressional delegation, a lot of national clout, a major producer of the nation's food, and a state which is in economic and water crisis right now. So what you're going to hear today is where the fight stands and what Glass-Steagall really means. It's not just a banking law. What it really means is destroying the Wall Street bankers, who are a tool for the British Empire. The British Empire, that's the controlling force in this process of using the banks and gambling speculation to kill off the population, cutting off their pensions, looting the cities and states of the United States, and reducing the United States from a great republic to a pile of rubble. So without further introduction, Diane, can you start and brief us on the fight in Atlanta and where the fight for the nation now stands?
Sure. It's clear that the fight over the Glass-Steagall resolution was the main event at this week-long convention. And it started actually before the convention, because we discovered when we got there, it was supposed to have been voted on initially in the Financial Services Committee. There was a representative from Delaware who had been planning to introduce it there, and her resolution was on the website of the National Conference of State Legislators, so it was well known. So just as we had been calling members of this committee, and I think three or four of them actually have been co-sponsors of Glass-Steagall resolutions in their home state, so we were mobilized. The Wall Street lackeys acting on behalf of the Queen of England and her depopulation agenda were also highly engaged. And we know this because when we reached some people, like I reached one representative whom we had not spoken with before from a state that is not one of the states with a Glass-Steagall resolution yet. And he said, oh, I just got a call about that. And I said, from whom? He said, oh, from the State Bank Association. They called me this morning. They called in the morning before the conference began. And I said, oh, what did they say about Glass-Steagall? And he said, I said, who was it again? He said, the bankers. I said, oh, they probably were against it. He said, yeah, I think that's right. But then we learned later that they were getting so exasperated and they didn't want to draw more attention or get people, you know, upset, because at this point, everybody in the universe thinks that people on Wall Street should be going to jail. It's public knowledge that they were rigging the interest rates and setting up these cities to be ripped off. So the bankers were resorting to telling these legislators, look, it's a very complicated issue. You should really not stick your neck out, just remain neutral, which is very funny. So there was a huge mobilization going into this conference from both sides, from LaRouche PAC and all of our volunteers around the country, all the work that we've done in the state legislatures, and from the side of Wall Street. And when we arrived and we had the first meeting where there was not a vote, what occurred was that there was a gaggle of bankers from Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, which even had a stand in the exhibit center where they were organizing legislators against Glass-Steagall, and they were there in force. And then the representative from Delaware spoke. She gave actually a very excellent speech, which ended with a point about PCORA putting these people in jail, and you could see a lot of squirming. And then Representative Perry Clark, Senator Perry Clark from Kentucky, who is not on the committee, but she yielded some of her time to him, and he was really sharp and said, this is a ripoff, and he had newspaper articles, a stack of them, on the criminal investigations going on against J.P. Morgan. It was very powerful. He said, this body needs to move and pass this resolution. And then finally we had Lamar Lemons, a former state representative who's currently the head of the Detroit School Board, and he just went through how Detroit had been destroyed, that Wall Street was the problem, and that it was urgent that this resolution be passed. So this was extremely powerful. The bankers were totally freaked out. The other thing of note is there were people in the hearing, like there was a guy from Ohio who wrote a blog which just came out yesterday. There were a lot of people at this event, the labor union activists and others, who were on our side, who really wanted Glass-Steagall to be passed. They knew it was necessary, and they were also highly moralized that such a fight was occurring. So at any rate, what happened was the representative from Delaware came under excruciating pressure, and the way they, what they did was they really pressured her whole delegation, that J.P. Morgan, as they had threatened in the banking committee hearing months ago, was threatening to pull 26,000 jobs out of the state. It would be very bad for the state. So the following morning, she withdrew the resolution. And
okay, let me ask you something here, all right? Let's freeze that moment. So the bankers went on an offensive, and that is really a fantastic description of the part of the meeting where the Delaware senator presented the resolution. Senator Perry Clark had the newspaper articles about J.P. Morgan's crime, and then Lamar Lemons, former state rep from Michigan, spoke. You mentioned PCORA. For our listeners, could you just elaborate a bit on PCORA, Ferdinand PCORA, the great ally of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s? Because I think that's a name that, you know, sends chills down the backs of J.P. Morgan.
Yes, sure. He was a prosecutor, and actually I think he was appointed to chair the Senate banking investigation before FDR came in, but then when FDR came in, it just became crucial. And what he did was he put these untouchables, the Wall Street millionaires, on trial in front of the Congress. You could have never gotten a trial outside of a public venue where you could put, and Jack Morgan Jr., J.P. Morgan's son, was given a prison sentence. What they found out was that all these guys had not paid any taxes for I don't know how long. She also went through the case of the National Citibank or whatever, which is now Citibank, and the head of that also was convicted and went to prison. And I think this was really crucial because similar to some of the nonsense in the lines that you get today. Well, oh, Detroit, it's just a bunch of lazy people who want too much money, or the depression is caused by all those middle-class people who don't want to work, and, of course, the upstanding Wall Street millionaires in their six-piece million-dollar suits. They would never stoop so low as to commit blatant theft, but what this served to do was completely destroy whatever credibility these Wall Street characters had and neutralize them as a force to be able to intervene and to stop FDR's Reconstruction policies.
Okay, so please continue. So these bankers, these people whose necks are on the line, if we succeed with Glass-Steagall, there's going to be another PCORA process. There's going to be another round of nationally known, nationally viewed trials of these people. And J.P. Morgan's already thrown a couple of low-level lackey gamblers, multimillionaires, of course, but still speculators who are taking the fall for billions and billions of dollars of losses in London, the London Whale operation. So, you know, they know that they have got to stop this process if they're going to survive, I guess. So please continue.
Okay. Yeah, so, and also I might say the way Glass-Steagall would work, because some people say, well, you know, how are we going to get a PCORA committee? The point is, if you're instating Glass-Steagall, someone has to go through the books of these banks, because they're going to have to sort out what's legitimate debt that's tied to something real, and what is this speculative gambling garbage. And once these books are opened, God knows what you're going to see, but I think it's not going to be a pretty picture. You're going to just see blatant theft, lying, crimes. It'll be quite a delightful process. So at any rate, what occurred is then she said, I still support Glass-Steagall, but because of pressure from my delegation, I have to withdraw this. So that was very fascinating, and everybody really sort of smelled a rat. One of the committee members told me at that moment he felt like he should have just jumped in and picked it up. I don't know if that would have been legal or not. At any rate, the way these things can work if we are determined and you sink your teeth in and don't give up is that it actually became a phenomenal organizing opportunity, because so many people were so angry that the resolution had been withdrawn. And what we discovered is that you could introduce it as an amendment to a resolution that was going to be debated in the general session, the very end of the entire week. They had a general business meeting to review all of the initiatives that had been presented before committees during the week. And you could not amend anything that had passed the committee unanimously, but if there were resolutions that had not passed unanimously, they were up for debate. So we scoured the resolutions, and we found one that had to do with reducing state budget deficits.
Oh, wow. A very hot topic.
Yes, and how perfect, given that so much of these state budget deficits were caused by interest rate swaps and all kinds of shady, you know, criminal garbage by these bankers. So what happened was a short three-point amendment was written up, making the point that if Glass-Steagall were reinstated, first of all, nationally, you could write off, you know, trillions of dollars of so-called debt, because we're not going to bail out the speculators, but also locally, you have at least, and I'm sure it's far more, but what various people have documented, $30 billion of money simply lost because of these interest rate swaps. So this was a totally relevant amendment to reducing the state deficits, not to mention we included that with Glass-Steagall, you would return to a system of credit, which would allow you to employ millions of people, thus increasing the tax base further, alleviating the debt situation. So anyway, what happened was several state legislators from Delaware, North Carolina, Maine, Washington, Kentucky, all became sponsors of the amendment. And what is
okay?
What happened?
Let me ask.
Go ahead.
I'm going to ask to Lena to say a few things right now, because what you're describing is a military campaign by the LaRouche PAC organizers. Really, a political military campaign where the seemingly high point of the Wall Street enemies' operations was turned into a rout, because I'm sure they did not expect this. But the fascinating thing about the sponsors of the amendment is it went far beyond one state legislator from Delaware plus Kentucky plus Michigan. And Lena, I'd like you to enlighten our listeners about how this process in the individual states and in the state legislatures, like in California, where LPAC just got a resolution to support Glass-Steagall recently introduced, how that works, because our listeners are also activists, and this inspiring story can actually bring a lot more surprise developments online. So, Lena, tell us about the California bill and the town hall events that are going on. The mood in these town hall event meetings seems to be, you know, the pitchforks are out.
Yes, definitely, definitely. No, what we had been doing a year ago, even longer than that, is going to all the town hall meetings, both for Congress and state representatives, and putting them on the spot on Glass-Steagall, and basically getting them an idea, particularly in the state house, that we were going to get Glass-Steagall introduced and passed. Now, we didn't have a roadmap in particular. We had what we had in the Congress earlier this year, and the idea was that if we got the state houses to pass resolutions, that would be the kind of pressure necessary to force the Congress in turn to pass it. Because, you know, as most of our listeners probably know, the state representatives, the representatives at the local level, are critical to the support for the congressman, or the congressman getting elected or not elected. So we fanned out, you know, kept a calendar of all these events, attended the events, got up when we had an opportunity, questions or just interventions, Glass-Steagall, Glass-Steagall, Glass-Steagall. And then we happened to go to one in a rather poor Hispanic area, and ran into this fellow, the assemblyman who eventually introduced the resolution, Assemblyman Roger Hernandez. And one of our activists with me just got up and said, you know, Glass-Steagall, and started describing what the banks had done to California, because the discussion was nominally on the California state budget and the problem had been solved. So our representative got up and said, you know, you're just hiding the debt and you're never going to be able to pay the debt, Glass-Steagall, and so on. And the assemblyman interrupted him to say, wait a minute, and then related that he had introduced a bill, which we knew nothing about. And this is, you know, sometimes we're organizing and we think, oh, we're just kind of putting one stone and the next stone and the next stone and the next stone. But this really demonstrated that what we'd been doing in the field for years, but particularly over the last 3 years, had created an environment where not just the anger against the banks, but the idea of a Franklin Roosevelt approach to dealing with the financial crisis was what was necessary. So he popped out and started discussing that he had introduced this bill about regulating essentially bankers giving credit cards to students and what they had to disclose and so on. It was relatively simple, but it basically meant that the banks had to tell the students certain specific things about fees and penalties and compound interest, much of course which the students didn't understand, and they just signed and the banks happily gave them these credit cards, and then of course they ended up with massive debt. So the assemblyman related this to his audience, telling them, listen to what I'm saying and then listen to what this man is saying, meaning our LPAC representative who had started the intervention and was interrupted. And so then he described
how he got not one vote in the banking committee where his bill was brought, and that the bankers were arrayed in the room. There were more bankers in the room than there were members of the committee. I think there are 13 members of the committee. And he was so shocked and was still smarting from this event that when we showed up at this meeting, it must have been about 2 months later, and we popped up with this whole question of Glass-Steagall and so on, he was ready to go. And so from that, we organized him. We just kept going up and down the halls of Sacramento, every office, Glass-Steagall, Glass-Steagall. The other thing that we did very consciously is we made the fight LaRouche versus Wall Street, in which, yeah, there was some, you know, technical discussion about Glass-Steagall, and we gave him the platform to study and so on, the various representatives and their aides, and we had the usual problem with aides. But we made it specifically LaRouche versus Wall Street, and, well, not as specific as now, the matter of actually destroying Wall Street. And so what happened is that eventually, because we got to not go through all the details, he introduced it after really largely recruiting his aide over a period of months, organizing the aide on history, on culture, on music, on economics, on the American system, on Alexander Hamilton, et cetera, et cetera. And this process actually we ended up doing with several aides who kind of sorted themselves out during the process from the whole lot of aides, most of whom are really just, at best, just kind of, you know, functionaries and don't have any kind of political or historical identity. And so he introduced the bill, and now we're in a fight to get it passed, and there's certain technical procedural hurdles that we're up against because the session's coming to an end and hearings are over and so on and so forth. But more importantly, the fight is now really, this is LaRouche, this is LaRouche, this is LaRouche. It's said explicitly, hasn't really been said explicitly too loudly, but this is the undercurrent in terms of co-sponsors and in terms of just breaking through the barriers of protocol and bringing it to a vote and getting it passed. And so that's the fight that we're in right now. And again, we're not just doing the fight in Sacramento. We're doing the fight out in the streets. I think this week, I'm not in California right now. This week, I think we're going to probably about 10, at least 10, maybe a dozen of these town hall meetings, both at the for congressmen and state representatives up and down the state with a copy of the resolution, telling them that they should sign on as a co-author or co-sponsor, and you know, setting up meetings with them in Sacramento and so on. So that, you know, in a nutshell, that's basically what the process has been.
Great, thanks. For our listeners, you're listening to the August 17th, 2013 edition, special edition of the LaRouche Show. This is your host for today, Michelle Steinberg. This special edition is called Report from Atlanta, Forget About Your Money, You're Fighting for Your Life. It is about the nationwide fight for Glass-Steagall. And we're going to go back to Diane Sayre from the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee to tell us about that battle in Atlanta, but also tell us about what the fight that Lena Platt just described in California has actually resulted in resolutions in 25 states. Listeners, this is a nationwide battle. Every single person in every single state of the United States and the territories can be a crucial part of this. So, Diane, I just wanted to, listeners to get the idea of how much their role and how much battling the consent of the governed in the 50 states went into this fight that we had in Atlanta. So back to you.
Okay. Well, just to give you a sense of the dynamic, because we were, you could almost say we were parachuted in there, meeting all these, I don't know if it was 700-800 legislators from all over the country, and you could definitely tell the difference between the states where we've had a large amount of activity and presence, the legislators that we've spoken with, and those that we had not. And I got a very clear sense of it. I was speaking with one representative who said to me, yeah, I got this package of literature. Your people were here in our state house. And then I was sort of looking at it, but it seemed a little complicated. But then another representative came into my office and said, hey, did you get this literature on Glass-Steagall? And I said, yeah, I don't know what to make of it. And the other legislator said, well, you should read it carefully. This makes a lot of sense. We should get with this. So wow. You can see that it's not just the one-on-one interaction between us organizing these legislators, but when we do things that are like a mass distribution or something that's more public, they get a sense, they know that everyone else has been approached. So that creates a buzz where they start all discussing it amongst themselves. Another thing that happened, and I think this makes it just the more crucial that we move very quickly to reach all of these people, and we keep, don't give up if you run into them once. This legislator must have run into us several times before she came a co-sponsor on the Glass-Steagall bill, because what happens is that you say something and it sort of registers or maybe not. Then they hear it again from another legislator. Then they find out that a town in their district has been looted $53 million because of an interest rate swap. And then they say, oh my goodness, those LaRouche people were telling me something about this. I really should get on board. And I think the one thing that we can have confidence about is that until Glass-Steagall is adopted, more and more cities and states and municipalities and sewer, you know, treatment plants and school districts are going to be clobbered with horrific losses because of these crazy investments, so that our audience is going to grow by leaps and bounds. And this has a huge impact on our ability to get things done, because what your run-of-the-mill politician will not say is that the intent is to kill you. But we are saying that, and if you look at the consequences, what does it do to a retiree in Detroit whose pension might be $32,000 for a year, which is already not very much, to suddenly discover they're going to get $3,200 to live on for an entire year and they're not getting Social Security? That is a death sentence. So we're not exaggerating, and we are the only people with the guts so far to put it in those terms, but that is what will recruit these people.
Well, obviously, that picture got through very, very clearly in a condensed period of time. Sometimes you only had maybe an hour to pull things together and work quickly. And I'm reading a LaRouche PAC description of one of your colleagues who was down there. The amendment was sponsored, as you mentioned, by a number of people, co-sponsored. Senator Perry Clark of Kentucky, Senator Marilyn Chase of Washington, Senator Bob Hasegawa from Washington, Ronald Waters, Pennsylvania, and Robert Saussier, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in Maine, and Representative Boland herself. And people can read about this whole fight. There were some really funny graphics going on as the debate, I understand. We were able to project images of Pecora and other things. Can you give us a sense of the tension in the room and what the bankers were up to as this was going on?
Yeah, sure. Well, in the committee hearing is where Senator Cloutier from Delaware was able to use overhead projections of Ferdinand Pecora and so forth. In the main plenum at the end, what happens is when someone rises to introduce an amendment, they put the amendment on two gigantic screens on either side of the podium. So everybody in the room was looking at this amendment for the 15 minutes or so that the debate was raging. And as soon as it was Representative Boland from Maine who rose to introduce the amendment, you could hear murmurs, groans, you know, it's a very mixed crowd. I was sitting to my left were a group of labor union officials, and to my right were a bunch of bankers. So they both had different responses. The union officials are very excited, the bankers were sort of chewing the rug. And then what you had was the representative from Maryland who clearly was chomping at the bit. And our supporters, the supporters of Glass-Steagall from all of these states, knew that they were in for a fight. In fact, one of them in the morning going in said, okay, so let's all make sure everybody be at the microphone. We are not going to let them shut us up. They're going to try to shut us up. So make sure all of us have a microphone as soon as the resolution that we're introducing gets put on the screen. So that was the other thing that was kind of a shift, because they were not going into this naive. They had seen, they had been at the committee meeting or been briefed on how the thing had been withdrawn, the intense kind of pressure. They all were expecting to get phone calls from the bankers and to, you know, attempts to harass them into backing down. And they were ready for a fight. One of them said the night before, bring them on, because she was angry about the controlled nature of various other discussions. So the thing was introduced, it was put up on the screens, and immediately I think they went to Maryland because Delaware would have been too obvious. So a representative from Maryland gets up and says, this resolution already has been withdrawn. I don't know why it was withdrawn, but you can't bring it up again, and it's not germane, which was the key. And then the chair, and then another representative, also from Delaware, but who is somewhat of a maverick, jumped up and he said, what do you mean it's not germane? It says in the rules that amendments can be introduced from the floor. You don't even have to have them in writing. You had this one in writing beforehand. Of course it's germane. It's about Glass-Steagall, and we're talking about, you know. So what happened was the chair then made her ruling that the amendment was not germane. So then the representative from Washington, Senator Chase from Washington, said, I appeal the ruling of the chair. And that opened a debate on whether the thing was germane. And you had a representative from, or senator from Rhode Island, who was arguing on behalf of the insurance companies that it was not germane. You had a completely sophistical argument from a senator from Utah who said, Glass-Steagall is very important and it does merit a debate. However, this resolution is not the place. It has nothing to do with deficit reduction and something or other, and therefore it is not germane. And then Senator Chase said, well, if we're arguing about whether it's germane, let me tell you what Glass-Steagall would do. It would separate commercial from investment banking. It would mean that your savings could not be used to speculate by the big banks. It would mean that J.P. Morgan Chase could not become an owner of electrical companies or aluminum warehouses. I mean, she was very sharp and gave a very good and clear description of what Glass-Steagall was and why it was absolutely germane and relevant to this. And then the representative from Delaware spoke again, and others who were sponsors were waiting at the microphones to speak again. Many representatives who we, you know, were just not sure that we knew were with us, but they've never spoken publicly before, were lining up at the microphones. So then someone from Minnesota said, well, I move that we vote on the motion of the chair, that this is not germane. So in this case, a vote yes meant that you supported the chair, that it was not germane. A vote no meant that you disagreed and thought it was germane. And interestingly, it was 32 who voted yes, and 11 voted no, and there were 4 abstentions. And there were a total of 47 states and territories present. I think the total number that they would have if everyone was present is 57, because it's the states, and then it's Puerto Rico and Guam and, you know, Virgin Islands, et cetera. So the 11, that was quite substantial because that meant that these states agreed, and it had to be a majority by state, so that a majority of their representation felt that Glass-Steagall absolutely should be debated. And before that abstained, what happened in those delegations, you could see it from the floor, is they were having gigantic arguments And basically, they couldn't agree what had the majority, for or against Glass-Steagall, so they had to abstain from taking a position.
Wow, you bet. And, you bet this is a real victory. I have the list. Let's let our listeners know the states that went clearly for the amendment on Glass-Steagall: Alabama, Arkansas, Idaho, Maine, where it's, Diane, that's already passed a Glass-Steagall resolution, am I right?
Correct, unanimously, yeah. In both houses. Yeah.
Unanimously, okay. Minnesota, Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico, Puerto Rico, Vermont, and Washington State, where, you know, Senator Maria Cantwell is one of the co-sponsors of a Senate bill reinstating Glass-Steagall. That is Senate Bill 1282. So, yeah, we've got a lot going on there. I think I missed a couple. The abstentions were Hawaii, Kansas, North Carolina, and Oregon. So, yeah, the fight is on. There's 15 states that clearly wouldn't go with stopping the Glass-Steagall amendment, and there is a fight in the 32 states that where they couldn't, you know, reach an agreement. So, or they still had dissenters. So this is pretty a pretty exciting situation overall.
I would just say in the 32 states, it's clear many of them will be turned to our side, because many of those states are states where we have Glass-Steagall resolutions, but for various reasons of manpower and this and that, we haven't been able to fully inform all of the legislators. But I think most of them, were we able to get to them, and this really is the work of the people listening, they would be for Glass-Steagall in the next round.
Now, both Diane and Lena have mentioned the importance of never giving up. The anecdote about the story of meeting assemblymen who had before he even met us about Glass-Steagall, had tried to introduce some constraints on speculation and found that his own banking committee was in the banker's pockets, and he now has become a sponsor of the Glass-Steagall. And I think what Diane said earlier, when you're determined and sink your teeth into a fight, it can be won. What one colleague from the one LaRouche PAC organizer called this, the principle of the cranes of Ibycus. I think this is a beautiful idea, and whichever one of you wants to talk about Friedrich Schiller, the poet of freedom, and what this image of the cranes of Ibycus is, please go ahead, both, even.
Well, the only thing I would say, I was thinking as Diane was describing the situation in Atlanta and the whole process, is how the more hysterical the enemy gets, the bankers' buddies get, or their little toadies get, the more the population is going to stand up against them and react against what they're doing. So the heavy-handed thug tactics are actually redounding against them. And this is, you know, from people like Roger Hernandez, for example, but also more and more from the population, because again, you know, as Diane said, people know that these policies are killing them. And sometimes you're out in the field with a book table and you start discussing, and, you know, you can discuss, for example, the situation in California, where we've had several cities declare bankruptcy, and where the state is paying, I forget, $300 and some million a year just in services and fees for the swaps, which they're losing a ton of money on. And, you know, so you say at the book table, you start discussing the effects of this policy, and before it can come out of your mouth, more and more people will say, this is killing people. They actually use the word kill. This is killing people, or this is genocide, or something like that. And so we're not at a point, I mean, and of course we don't need to get 50% or 90% or something. We're at the point where enough of the population knows that this is a killer policy, that they have gone so crazy and arrogant, the oligarchy, that the population is just up in arms in reaction to what they've done. Our main thing, of course, is getting the population to act with us in the correct way, you know, not going crazy French Revolution style, but also educating the population on what after Glass-Steagall, you know, what's the program for economic recovery after Glass-Steagall. And so a lot of our effort also with the population is NAWAPA, is, you know, the PCORA Commission, obviously, but then NAWAPA and the positive programmatic alternative ideas. And the population, you know, the Shelley principle, the population is responding in a more and more intelligent way to these ideas. And so, you know, I don't think that you know, once we got New York in particular and then California, that the importance of these states, I don't think that the enemy can win. It's just that we've got to intensify what we're doing with the population, and they can't win. And the more crazy they get and desperate they get, the more we're going to be able to recruit more and more of the population to not just agree with us, but to act with us.
Could you say a little bit more about the NAWAPA and the whole development perspective as people are seeing it in California? One thing, if I could just throw in here, that that was fascinating from one of the LaRouche PAC interventions at the town hall meeting of Representatives Gloria Negrete McLeod. The district is Fontana, and I'll quote from this. This is where the largest steel mill west of the Mississippi was built during World War II. It produced steel for the shipyards in Los Angeles. It was modernized for the last time in the early 1980s, and then shut down a few years later. In the early 1990s, it was disassembled and shipped to China. It had employed 10,000 workers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, this has been the model in California. You know, the aerospace industry has been virtually shut down. We just went to a forum with a congressman and three or four state representatives, a forum, and they're, you know, sitting there talking about building drones, that's the way to revive the aerospace industry. And saying that, then we went to another forum, and they're boasting that they're using the same amount of energy today that they did 30 years ago, and they don't see that something's wrong with that when the population has grown so much in the last 30 years. And so when we bring NAWAPA in, and when we bring in the whole question of just reindustrialization and nuclear energy, because they've shut down San Onofre nuclear plant and fusion energy, we're trying to rekindle in Californians the idea of California being at the leading edge of industry, of science, of technology, not just the Silicon Valley stuff, but real serious industrial development, production, and third world economic development, and connecting to it the whole idea, if we're going to have peace in the world, if we're not going to have chaos constantly in these countries, we've got to have a development perspective for the third world, which means we've got to get these aerospace industries or steel industry or whatever up and running to rebuild our own nation, so that in turn we can rebuild the world as a war avoidance policy. And so connecting also the war threat to the economic collapse and the fight around Glass-Steagall also gets people to start thinking of the whole question on a higher level.
So, Diane, back to you and the East Coast perspective on this. You come from, you're living in a state that Alexander Hamilton played a major role. And where do we go now from in rebuilding the country, getting ready for Congress to return, and the other parts of the Glass-Steagall fight, jailing the bankers, auditing the banks, getting rid of the gambling debt, and a national credit system? Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think one of the very exciting things that came up in the discussion of Detroit
And a couple of years ago, when I was running for Congress here, Mr. LaRouche described New Jersey as being part of the Midwest, or he talked about the corridor. It was quite humorous, but from Detroit heading east, because you have Pennsylvania, you have Ohio, you have New Jersey, you have these high-tech areas in Connecticut and Long Island. If you think of that as one very, very productive area, potentially. And one of the things that has come up in Detroit is because the...
Hold on. We've got some interference background noise. Maybe that's Lena needs to mute her phone. Okay, Diane, back to you.
Okay. One of the things that had come up is the machine tools which produce the components for automobiles can be retooled. People can be retrained, and they can produce parts for many, many things, high-speed rail and emphatically nuclear power plants. And one idea that had come up is Detroit as a mass production center for nuclear power plants, because if you're mass producing nuclear plants, first of all, the cost goes down dramatically. Secondly, it's frankly insane that we haven't become a nuclear power-based economy long before now. And thirdly, if we wanted to revive our industrial and manufacturing capability, and not to mention agriculture, because agriculture now uses all kinds of very high-tech, energy-dense technology, we actually would blow out the current power grid. You have an insane policy in New Jersey called the Energy Master Plan to reduce electricity consumption by 20%. Mm. Well, then you might as well just say we're going to have everybody be unemployed and dead. We're going to give up on refrigerators and air conditioning. I mean, it's really key. So we need nuclear power. We need to invest in technologies that will allow us to leapfrog. We were struck in New Jersey and New York by Sandy. We shouldn't be thinking of rebuilding, because that's too low level. Why do you want to rebuild broken down, old, outdated infrastructure when you could build new, fully modern storm surge barriers? We should be working on fusion energy. We have the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab here, and I think Mr. LaRouche's conception of a nuclear NOAPA, where we're using nuclear fission but moving to fusion as a driver of that whole project, would transform the United States, the entire continent, the United States from coast to coast. And this is only possible, of course, if Glass-Steagall is reinstated and we reestablish what Alexander Hamilton intended, which is a credit system form of economics.
Moving to the future, we were just reviewing here in Leesburg Mr. LaRouche's brand new paper. Subject, We Against the British Empire, Mankind's True Intention, How the Future Builds Its Past, which is always one of Lyndon LaRouche's most interesting, paradoxical, and challenging ideas, the relationship of the future and the past. And in this document, which will be in an upcoming issue of Executive Intelligence Review, he really discusses this idea of man's true mission in determining the future, which is really what this is about. I mean, we're not pushing Glass-Steagall because we want to go back to the 1930s or because it would have prevented Lehman Brothers from going under, which used to be what the bankers would say, or Barney Frank, from the author of the stupid Dodd-Frank useless legislation that does nothing to restore the economy. It wouldn't have stopped Lehman Brothers from going under. Well, who wanted to stop Lehman Brothers from going under anyway? The issue is the future. The issue of the future is stopping this policy of genocide that both of you have been discussing and The new paper by Mr. LaRouche, I just urge everybody to get it as soon as possible. Subscribe to Executive Intelligence Review. Go to our website. Follow this Atlanta battle. Some people call it the second battle for Atlanta. And get with this fight for Glass-Steagall. Now is the time. Well, here's the quote that I wanted to highlight from Mr. LaRouche. Classical poetry, classical drama, and classical music exemplify who and what I am in that to which I am the most devoted, including the love for the very idea of what mankind should be able of becoming. However, the heart of it all is my devotion to the participation in the future, what mankind should be capable of becoming. Now is the time to become very serious. We have a few more minutes left, and I'd like to just open it up first to Diane, then to Lena, to give us some parting thoughts about what to do next.
Well, I think we have to really inform ourselves what the stakes are and to try never to put things in the terms of popular opinion or popularly accepted politeness, because it really is the case. The Queen, her royal consort, Prince Philip, they have publicly said that they intend that the planet should only have a billion people on it. That means that that's the policy, and therefore it's not an accident that stealing people's pensions or the rip-offs of the municipalities will actually increase the death rate. That's known. So I think one is that people should be very, very clear. We're dealing with a criminal apparatus with criminal intent. That doesn't mean that your local bank teller intends to murder you. There's a lot of local people in banking who would be much happier doing legitimate savings and loans and, you know, helping their communities grow and being part of something productive. But at the top, and I think that's where this Ibicus question you brought up comes in, because the way that it worked is that the cranes of Ibicus, who was murdered on the highway on his way to this poetry competition, and the cranes flew overhead, and he called out to them, "Avenge me." And then what happened, the murderers knew that that had occurred. Then there, with big crowd at the poetry festival, everyone is completely upset that Ibicus isn't there, that he's been murdered. And what happens is the cranes fly overhead, and the murderers can't help themselves. They reveal their identities, crying out, "Oh, the cranes of Ibicus." Yep. And therefore, when we fight on the standard of the truth, what happens, and we saw it in Atlanta, is that the enemy is forced to expose themselves before full public view as to what their evil intent is and who they are. And that's how they can be defeated. And that's a universal principle, which is why we can win.
Thank you. Lena?
Yeah, the only thing I would say in conclusion, I think Diane summed it up well. The only thing I would say in conclusion, particularly to our listeners, is to activate yourself. People are sitting around, they're very angry, they're very demoralized, they're frustrated at the political situation, and they don't see a very good future. And only if you fight for that future will you be able to see it. And so look into your computer, find a congressional meeting, find the congressional offices, find the state representatives' offices, and go to those meetings and bring reality to those meetings. In many cases, only when some representative of the LaRouche Pact speaks is reality brought and a solution brought. And so I would just really urge your listeners, don't just participate in what we have, the conference calls, the chapter meetings, that's all good. But go out to the population, go out to the town meetings, intervene with our elected representatives. Some of them still have consciences and souls, and they will move. And so that's pretty much what I would say.
That's great.
And thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Diane. I've got to run. I'm sorry.
Okay, Lena, thank you for joining us and
okay.
for all your reports.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, Diane, we have a few minutes left. People who are listening obviously know our website. I'm going to give a telephone number. This is a long-distance number, 703-777-9451. And you can get a switchboard there between business hours during the day and get in touch for more information if you need it. Our websites are extremely user-friendly. You can, through the www.larouchepub.com, where you're listening to this show, you will also see the entire archive of EIR since the beginning of the publication in the 1970s. You can purchase special reports. You can also get connected to the LaRouche PAC website, the Schiller Institute, and our amazing international array of websites in their native languages. We have 2 minutes left, Diane. Are you in a position to tell us about the international support for Glass-Steagall?
Sure. Just quickly, I know there was just a really historic conference of elected officials from Germany and France making the point that there has to be a stand taken by their governments from these, you know, against this financial dictatorship. And I would just say, having been at a conference a few months back sponsored by the Schiller Institute in Frankfurt, it became very, very clear that these nations are really under a dictatorship of the European Central Bank, the European Union, and Americans should not be so naive as to think it won't happen here, but also that when we act in the United States, we are taking the point and we are acting for the leaders of these nations who have, at the moment, a very reduced sovereignty under these, you know, multinational banking institutions. So they also are depending on us to act in the spirit of the founding of the United States, and that will liberate the whole planet.
Well, that is the perfect note to on which to end. And Diane Sayre, thank you for being with us today. Again, www.larouchepub.com, where you're listening to this show. Visit the other websites, and as Lena Platt told our listeners, get active. You can make a crucial difference. That's all
Great.
For today. Thank you again.
Thanks.